I gotta hire a dev who can do this thing. Oh, cool. What other companies have done that? Oh, right. No one. That's why your company is unique. So you have to figure out how to do this thing on the computer that's never been done. And you've got to hire people that can help figure this out with you and aren't just going to leave you in the lurch or steal your IP. Okay, good luck.
I have a working theory about entrepreneurs, that some of us are born with a quirk that gives us a near infinite tolerance for risk. Not only has my guest today lived an incredibly risky, adventurous, and successful life, but his story also lends some credence to my theory, as there's something about his life that sounds, I guess, eerily familiar. What's up, guys? I'm John Roa, and welcome to Between Us, where we get the stories of vulnerability behind success. On today's show, podcasting legend Jordan Harbinger of The Jordan Harbinger Show. Today, we're going to talk about the endless deluge of advice on social media and how toxic that can be. We'll also talk about how he grew a small show about pickup artistry into one of the world's most successful podcasts. And finally, we'll get into these crazy adventures that he's had exploring his creative side, including both of the times he's been kidnapped. Without further ado, here's Jordan Harbinger. So how often do you get interviewed?
All the time.
Do you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you like being interviewed or do you like interviewing more?
I mean, this is certainly easier.
Yeah.
There's less prep, namely zero. So that's always nice. I mean, being interviewed, it's fine. It's fun. It sort of depends. I mean, some hosts are really bad.
Yeah.
You know, like they'll be like, so what's your top three tips for being a good podcaster? And I'm just like, fuck, this is so lame. You know, or they're like, what would you tell yourself when you were 20? And I'm like, right. I don't know. Don't go to college.
Exactly.
But then that's not good advice for you.
Right.
You should go to college. You're probably not going to be well off at whatever you do if you don't.
I've told you this, that advice giving is like one of my least favorite things in the world. And I think that it is one of the most toxic things you can do is just start throwing general advice out there.
Totally.
Every like of those, yeah, those listicle articles of like the top 10 things to do if you want a blank. I think if you try to follow any of those like in isolation, you just fail instantly. I think like, and it's just, it's amazing that that's what people want to consume as if it is the right way to do things. Just blows my fucking
mind.
Yeah,
there's tons of people that there's always trends that go on because of these dumb influencer guys.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I saw in some video from such and such guy that like the most important skill set is being able to direct sell. And I'm like, well, that's because that asshole owns an MLM company.
Exactly.
Of course he wants you to get into direct sales.
Exactly.
Then you have to sign up for his stupid thing where you pay him money to, you know, exist. And he tells you you're a business owner, but you really don't own anything.
Right.
You just have to buy shampoo every month. You know, of course he's going to give you the advice that sales is the best skill set. Now, look, don't get me wrong. Sales is an awesome skill set that I think almost everyone should have, but some people are not ever going to be good at it.
Right.
And if you can't get good at it or you hate it, don't be like, well, but Donald Trump said direct sales was the best skill set. This is before he became a president.
Right.
But somebody was arguing that MLMs are really good. This is like literally like 10 years ago. MLMs are objectively terrible. They're 99.6 or something percent of people lose money doing it. Like, yeah, there's the only reason they're not illegal pyramid schemes is because they pretend to have a product that's for sale, yeah, that nobody really cares about or uses. But the guy's argument was like, oh, well, Donald Trump said if he could do it all over again, he wouldn't do real estate. He would do direct sales. And I was like, well, he was obviously paid to say that, you effing moron.
Exactly.
You know, so like,
it's amazing.
You have all this advice that is actually just sales in disguise. Or like designed that, or yeah, advice that sales in disguise, like designed to get you to do something else.
I think it's that, or people that they believe because they're in a position of giving advice, it makes them somehow their advice meaningful. And so it makes them look smart or powerful or influential. And you read these like quotes. I actually put one in my book about, I think it was Tony Robbins. And it's just like, you know, it's one of those like, if you fail, then you actually succeeded because that's when we learn. And it's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah,
like,
I know, I hate that stuff.
This is the dumbest like sentiment. And people just absorb it because it sounds intelligent, even though it's absolutely fucking meaningless or worse.
Tony Robbins is famous for this kind of thing, right? Like, he didn't invent this. In fact, I don't think he invented pretty much anything that he's done. Yeah. But he's famous for doing, I can't remember exactly what this logical fallacy is called. But it's when you say something that rhymes or sounds clever and people go, oh, well, then it must be true. So people give undue credence to it. What's one of these dumb influencer quotes I heard recently? Like, you either grow exponentially or you die, or you don't grow. Like, what's the opposite? He said, or you like die or you decrease asymptotally or something like that. Right. And I'm like, no, some people just have steady growth rates, growth rate or a fluctuating growth rate. Nobody's necessarily growing exponentially or declining asymptotally. You're just using math words that make you sound intelligent. So 18-year-old dude bros
who
are watching your stupid YouTubes are like, oh yeah, you're either growing exponentially or something asymptote. Yeah. I don't know. Like, good job, Ty Lopez. You know, and I'm gonna name check because that's who it was. But it's just, it's stupid crap like that. Or it rhymes.
Right.
A lot of people like to rhyme. Yep. And so they'll do these sort of like rhyming slogan things, and then if you think about it for more than 5 seconds, which almost no one does, you're like, that's just not even true. This is not accurate at all.
Correct. And especially when you talk about like life quotes, it's like, okay, fine, you get into business, entrepreneurship, investing, those kind of things, people take that shit seriously. They might go make a decision based off that bullshit, and that's what gets scary. And so the whole like mentor advice thing to me is just is very scary for people who are trying to succeed, because they end up listening to this crap or reading the books or whatever, signing up for these webinars that are actually just, to me, would put you further back than not doing it in the first place.
I didn't even realize this was a thing.
Right.
That people were using. Like, I didn't realize there was an actual name for the logical fallacy of something that just sounds clever.
Yeah, well, the psychology of it makes a lot of sense, right? Like, you can see why that would work, because it sticks in your head, it sounds clever. It makes sense, but it's also just very sad. I fucking hate that stuff, man. It drives me crazy.
It's designed to, like you said, it's designed to get people to believe something that is not necessarily true by covering it up with something that makes it easier to remember.
Exactly. Because
I don't think it's just dumb people that fall for this. I think maybe there's something in our brain that goes, okay, if I can sort of comprehend this easily and then remember it, it's probably true,
100%.
But that's not the case at all.
100%. Right?
Like, you know, just because you could rhyme something doesn't make it true. And nobody would ever assert that. But if somebody gives you advice and it rhymes, it's like, well, that must be true. Look
brilliant.
At that.
Wow. Brilliant.
How convenient.
Exactly. Well, I had you on 2 months ago to kick off my new podcast. And I promised to ask you this question when we started your interview, which was, why the hell have you been kidnapped twice?
Oh yeah. So the short version of these stories is, one, I was 20 and I was in a taxi in Mexico, and it turned out to be one of those like kidnap the tourist taxis, like a fake taxi. And I ended up escaping from that by just struggling with the cabbie after a while. And then the other time was when I lived in Serbia, not Siberia, but the former Yugoslavia, which is an awesome place, but I had failed to register inside the country once as a foreigner, and that was illegal. I don't think they probably do this anymore. It's very like socialist. It's very authoritarian to make people register when they're foreign. You have to go to the police. They stamp your passport. They take a copy of it. You tell them where you're staying, why you're there. Like, usually you do that at immigration. In Serbia, you do it at immigration and you have to go to the police, and they can visit you at any time and just sort of check up on you. It's like an anti-espionage thing. And I was like, to hell with this, because I would go there, they'd make me wait like 4 hours, and then they'd like throw me to jail cell because they were like, ugh, the guy who does this isn't going to be here till the morning. I'm like, cool, I'll come back. And they're like, no, wait in this locked room with a bunch of prostitutes that are smoking.
Is that right?
All night. What's that?
That's what happened?
Yeah. That's but that was the last time. They threw me in a cell full of these Roma women that were like chain smoking and talking in their language. And I was like, they're just not going to go to bed. So I woke up with like a sore throat, sore eyes, because they were like chain smoking unfiltered cigarettes, you know, and they weren't bad people, but they were super ghetto, and they were, you know, I hadn't committed any crime. And I was like, this is just some lazy shit ass policeman doesn't want to fill out a form. So I get to spend the night in jail on a Tuesday, like, and then try to go to work, you know. Fantastic. And then my boss was like, you're late. And I was like, I was in jail. And she's like, well, okay, that's a pretty good excuse.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, then she's like, well, why don't you come in earlier and register? And I was just like, you know, to hell with this bullshit. So I stopped registering. And then the police were like, oh, you must be a spy.
So makes sense.
They sent the state security agents after me and like took me and my friend. And it was just a whole cluster. And we eventually just were such a pain in the ass that we told them we needed water. There was no water in the building where we were. So they went and got some, thinking that we were incapacitated. And then I was just like, all right, we're out of here. So then we just walked out the front door, more or less, and escaped.
It's fantastic.
Wild. Yeah.
What work were you doing in Serbia?
Well, part of the reason I was under such suspicion was because I was there with a scholarship from the Department of Defense to research some Serbian stuff. So they were like, oh, you're already, you know, working for a spy country and a spy organization. And, forget that it was like an academic fellowship. Like it was like a Fulbright type of thing called ACTR Excels. It's very similar to a Fulbright in that way. And they just don't have that over there. Like, right. Unless you're politically connected, you don't get scholarships from the government from Eastern Bloc countries. So they just kind of assume that if you're getting that from the United States or the West, you're a spy.
Right.
You know, why? And also if you're politically connected, why would you? I remember the state security agents talking to each other and going, he's obviously a spy because who gets a scholarship from their government and then decides to come to Serbia, right? Like, why didn't he go to France? Why didn't he go to Australia?
You're like Belgrade's beautiful in June.
It is actually a really nice place.
I've been. It's great.
I believe you because it seems like it's your kind of place. And it is a great place. And I have a lot of friends there that I'm still in touch with. But the authorities, they're just like, they couldn't wrap their mind around that in 2004, some college kid worked his ass off to get a scholarship to go to Serbia after already having been there for a year as an English teacher. They were just like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like I was the only person they'd ever even heard of who would come from the United States, go to Serbia, and wasn't just a Serbian guy living in America that was visiting his family. They were just like, it doesn't make any sense.
So speaking of working hard, you've had a strange career. Now, I was obviously known you as a friend and read up more for today. And I'm like, you've got to have one of the more unique career paths I've probably ever heard. You were a Wall Street lawyer. When was that?
That was 2006 to 2008, something like that.
Okay.
It was a short-lived career. So I, whenever people are like, oh, you're a lawyer, I'll be like, let me stop you right there. You're going to want to ask a real attorney about this particular problem, you know, which is kind of nice because usually they actually need real advice. And, you know, lawyers hate giving real advice when they're not being retained because usually there's a lot of nuance and they can get in trouble. And I'm always like, hey, you should not rely on my legal advice. And they're like, oh, okay, good tip, you know. But yeah, it was a short-lived career, but it was good because I got a chance to see what finance people do all day. And I was like, this sucks so much. There's no way anybody likes this.
100%.
Yeah.
And I love this. You then get into the podcast game in the early days doing a pickup podcast. Is that like a pickup artist kind of thing?
Yeah. I was like, oh, there's this whole sort of like dating techniques that nobody's talking about. And so I started to research this stuff on my own. I didn't realize there were all these like D-bag pickup guys running around.
Right.
We weren't really a part of all that. And then later, as we started the podcast, people were like, oh, you must know this guy and this guy and this guy. And I was like, no, not really. But I knew some of the OG dudes from internet forums.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. So this is a bigger scene than we thought. Like we were just talking to a couple guys out in California. There were some local guys. Then Neil Strauss, who's a buddy of mine, wrote this book called The Game.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, this is cool. It's like a book about us, like what we are doing. And, you know, there's these characters in there that aren't named after us necessarily, but are like us. You know how authors put people together and they pack them into one character?
Yeah.
What's that?
Composites.
Yeah, composites.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I was like, that's cool. You know, you can sort of, I remember that story and that story. That was actually this other guy who's not in the book, I guess this one guy is both now. And it's like that kind of thing. So that was really cool. But then it really quickly turned into like, all these kind of two standard deviations away from like really misogyny kind of date rapey situations.
The whole pickup artist community is a really creepy kind of incel kind of bat. You know, that is I had a friend who did one of these like seminars when he was like super young and didn't quite realize what the real culture of it was. And he left there like thoroughly creeped out of just how misogynistic and how almost abusive that the point of view is from this whole pickup artist world, at least 10 years ago or whatever.
No, it's true. And I can't imagine that it's gotten much better. I mean, back then it was weird because me and my friends who were doing it, we would meet up with other guys and we were like, these guys are really cool. You know, this is like really fun. And then we'd meet the occasional creep and we'd go, oh man,
right,
that guy he's weird. And then we started going and meeting these larger groups of people and we were like, oh, wait a minute. 99% of these guys are really, really weird.
Right.
Or 98, you know, 95, whatever.
Yeah.
And so we started to realize that it wasn't just like a group of normal guys who want to learn about women and improve themselves. It was like, we were the weirdos that just wanted to improve ourselves. Yeah. Everyone else was like, what's the secret gamer code to getting a woman to be naked with you? And I was just like, I got to get out of here. So when I started that show, I quickly realized that we had to pivot that into being more about the guys than about the women, because the guys who were coming in were not only not going to be even able to get a quality woman in their life because they were just such a disaster, but they were such a disaster that the logical place to start was not like figure out how to talk to women. It was like, okay, you need to get therapy. You need to lose 70 pounds. You need to like leave your house and start being, you know, you need to be able to look the cashier in the eye.
Right.
You're not going to some hot club and pulling out women. Like you're light years away from that. So it started to become kind of like therapy, and I really started to dislike it. And then when we were running our workshops and things like that, we were like, okay, we want to cater to the top end of this group. So we had a lot of married guys that were like, look, I just want to get better at sales. I was like, great. Or we'd teach corporate seminars and things like that. And it would be like, we're just going to take the pickup E part completely out of it. We had armed forces groups, like special forces guys coming in as a unit. They would come in.
But no way. That's crazy.
Yeah. We had a really high end clientele, but then I realized, you know, this is just, it started to get really bad because as it got more mainstream, you started to get more and more of like you said, like the incel kind of damaged person. And you'd get guys that were like, yeah, I'm going through a divorce. My ex-wife, she's such a, you know, terrible person. She's trying to take my kid from me. And then like, as the week progresses, you're just like, so you're an alcoholic. You hate women. You lost your job. You'd mistreat everyone. I can imagine your wife is running for the hills and probably stayed with you for way too long. You're the problem. Not like women are so bad. It was like these guys are the problem. So we started to really realize that it was kind of like, trying to think of an analogy here. Every time we told people what we did, they'd be like, oh, gross, you do that. And we're like, no, it's this other way. And then I was like, you know, we're like the drug dealers that don't put fentanyl in their heroin, right? Like we're the good guys. And it just doesn't make any sense to continue doing this. Plus, I met the woman that was going to become my wife and is now my wife. And I was like, it's a little inauthentic for me to be like, yeah. And then when you go do this and that and the other thing, because I'm like, the last time I did that 5 years ago now, you know, three years ago now, what am I doing? So we'd hire younger guys. And then it just became like, they would quit and start their own thing and steal a bunch of our clients and then leave them in the lurch because they were too lazy to do the work. And I was like, this is just such a dumpster fire waiting to happen. And then I left that whole industry, just couldn't stand it anymore. Really liked personal growth and realized, okay, the whole pickup thing, dating thing, even just talking about dating and relationships is not for me, you know, especially with awesome counselors around there, like Esther Perel, who's a good friend of mine, you know, just AKA qualified people to talk about this. There was no room for me in my opinion and in that space. So I just left. And then like a year or two after I left, the Me Too movement really kicked off. And I was just like, yeah, we're good thing that I got ahead of this.
Yeah, but 100%.
I left my old company and those guys are now like, yeah, picking up women here, there, and the other thing. And I'm like, you guys really just, you know, now they're just so niche. They're stuck in that.
It's like a Wedding Crashers vibe, just like still going after way too many years.
Yeah. And it's and like one of the guys is like 45. And I'm like, dude, it's so sad that you're single and hitting the bars on a Tuesday in Hollywood. Like what? Like, holy pathetic.
Yeah. But it sounds like a lot of the core kind of lessons, learnings about the human psychology, about connecting with people is what has brought you to today, right? Because that really is your whole platform today. And you talk a lot about networking, a lot about sales, a lot about all of that. And so it does sound in a very strange way that the kind of pickup side of what you did has brought you to your podcast.
Definitely. Like, I love human behavior, influence, persuasion, but I always came at it from the angle of bettering yourself, learning to like the most persuasive thing is if somebody actually already wants to do it, right? Like not convincing someone, but kind of being so good they can't ignore you. Right. So like our chief, here's an example, like our chief bit of advice that I found just to fall on deaf ears, which is one of the reasons I got so tired of doing the pickup and dating thing was, hey, look, doesn't matter what you say, doesn't matter what you do. you have to be building a life for yourself that is so inherently attractive because you're happy, you're fulfilled, you like who you are, you've got a vibrant social circle of friends from both the opposite sex and the same sex, and you're inviting people into that world, and that's what makes you attractive. And the guys would be like, yeah, but what do I say to her when I go and start? And I'm like, oh, irrelevant, you know? Right, and yeah. So I realized pretty quickly, I like helping people, but it doesn't just have to be guys. And I'm really interested in the psychology, the science of personal development, but not self-helpy crap like we were just talking about earlier in the show, about like the whole sort of Tony Robbins, it rhymes, so it must be true kind of stuff. You know, like I'm not like, go in the corner and power pose, you know, like we're not doing that. So I realized, hey, look, I can expand my mandate, if you will, and help men and women. They don't have to be young single people. They can be older married people. I'm really just into human performance, but mostly psychology. So that's really where the foundation came from. It just happened to be pretty damn cool when I was 26 to focus on dating.
Right.
But as I outgrew that, it wasn't like, oh, I have no skills now. It was oh, look, all the stuff that we talked about being a good person, being organized, developing yourself, creating good mindsets and like performance routines, that's what grownups need. So we can outgrow this other crap and kind of leave it behind, and the butterfly can emerge from the cocoon. And some of the people that worked with me at that old company were able to do that and left with me. And some of the people were like, nah, we're good just sort of teaching guys how to pick up chicks. And it was like good riddance, you know, to that particular element of the business.
Right. I mean, it's phenomenal. And I love that transition. And I think it speaks to you as a person and what's brought you to your podcast. And so in the podcasting world, you're one of the original guys and one of the biggest. I mean, your show was 2018 was one of the top 10 in the world or the country.
Yeah,
or?
It was when I rebranded, it was one of the most downloaded new show. Yeah, it was like the top 20 or top 25 most downloaded new show of 2018. So Apple picked it as the best of 2018 or one of the best of 2018.
It's unbelievable. And what is it about your show? What is it about what you put on and how you do it and why you do it that makes it that interesting and that unique?
Yeah, you know, good question. I mean, some of it is just first to market advantage or early to market advantage, but you can't really, you know, at first I kind of just went, you know, I've been doing it since 2006. But then I realized, you know, I know a lot of people that have been doing this since 2007, 2008. Right. They don't have a show that's 2 years away from being where I'm at. They've got a show that's never going to be where our show is. So what is it? And I think for me, it's just that I've become over the last few years, or several years, kind of obsessed with how do I get the best out of the guest? Because before it was, how do I get the best out of my clients with like the dating stuff? Then I was like, wait, I want to get the best out of myself, but I also want to get the best out of my guests. So I'd spend 10, 20 hours prepping for an interview. And then it's like, okay, great. Then I had an audio editor that goes, the interviews are so good, but the editing sucks because I was doing it myself. So I gave him a couple episodes. Well, a couple. I gave him episodes every week for, I don't know, like 2 years to edit for free. And he did it as a hobby. And people were like, this is so much better. It's so much better. And he was really meticulous. So he works with me still after 10 plus years, still edits the show. And I was like, you know, this whole thing is a labor of love in a lot of ways. Now it makes money through advertising. Before, we used to sell programs and services and things like that for the dating stuff that I'm glad I don't have to do anymore. But we just put a lot of energy into it. And I realize also that I look at a lot of competitors, and they're not really competitors. Like, it's podcasting. People can listen to like 10 of these things. Yep. But when I say competitors, I just mean other podcasts. I'll look at other podcasts and I'll say, wow, this show was really good. How many people work on it? Just these two hosts? Like, who else? You have an engineer? And I'll go to the website and there'll be like 28 people working on it.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll go, you got 12 people and an intern and a marketing team or whatever. And you put out 37 episodes a year. And then you read on their blog, like, we just need some time off. Everyone's so burned out. It's impossible to get, you know, we only had 10 more days until we have to start the next season, or like, oh, we spend 14 days working on each episode and da, 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 it's impossible. We're working 7 days a week. And I'm just like, there's like a handful of people here. And most of what I'm doing is reading. Nobody's working 7 days other than me, because I'm kind of a workaholic. And half the time, again, I'm just reading books. What are you doing? And I realized I learned how to edit. I learned how to record. I learned how to storyboard a story. I learned how to get the best out of an interview. I learned how to research. all these other podcasts, they have a person or two that specifically goes and does that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is our West Coast guy who travels all over and gets sound samples. What? No, I do that, you know? Right. So I realize now, and some of this is just entrepreneur mindset, is I have to know everyone's job almost as well as they do. And then they specialize from there, but I have to know pretty much what everyone's doing. And there isn't anything that I could do. I would say that most of the stuff that my team does, I could do not as well as them, obviously. But I could, if every single person got sick in the company, I could still do an episode of this show. I wouldn't be like, I don't know how to upload right. the file. I could still do it.
Well, it's so interesting because you just said what I was about to come in with is the entrepreneurial mindset. You are describing the quintessential mindset of an entrepreneur, right? Who has to know every piece of their business, but is also going to find people more qualified or talented than them to do each piece of the business. When did you figure out that you were an entrepreneur? Because you started down a very different track being an attorney. And then even the podcasting, I mean, it doesn't sound like it was like a hustle grind entrepreneurial kind of thing. So when did that click in for you that you realized you really are an entrepreneurial minded guy?
Yeah, that's interesting. So nobody even used the word entrepreneur very often until I'm going to say like 2013, 2014. That's when it started to trend. And we could probably look in Google and find out when right, like yeah. the word entrepreneur started to become something that gets searched every 5 seconds. But nobody called it that. And there wasn't this sort of like, yeah, bro, hustle and grind in 2007. It was like, go to your job. Yeah. What do you mean you work at home? There weren't even professional YouTubers because I don't think YouTube existed.
If it did, there wasn't content creators at that point, no.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I mean, the people that were popular on YouTube is like Jenna Marbles or something like that. Yeah. I don't know if she's, I think she's still around. And they were putting videos up on Barstool Sports, which is like a sports score website yeah. at the time and not a huge multi-million-dollar media company. And so like nobody was thinking, I'm going to be a podcaster. I'm going to be a YouTuber. It's just this niche thing. And I started to do that show when I was still in law school, didn't consider it a business. Got a job at Sirius XM doing my show in the evening on Friday during the evening drive. Didn't consider it a business. Quit law. Started doing the coaching and the podcast full time. Considered it a business because it was, but wasn't like, I'm an entrepreneur. Just did it.
Right.
Learned. Then our sales guy quit after not telling us anything for 2 weeks because we had moved away and opened up another office. And we're like, why is sales so low? We called him on his birthday and we're like, happy birthday. Hey, don't want to bug you, but how come sales are so low? And he's like, kind of took another job. And we're like, you're the worst person ever. You just left us screwed.
Right.
So I had to learn how to sell. And then I realized I was just doing everything in the business. So when did I turn around and say I'm a business owner, entrepreneur? I don't know. I mean, 2020 hindsight, looking at things I did when I was a kid were pretty good indicators that I was going to be a business owner. Yes. And I should never have gone to law school or college, probably for that matter, now that I think about it, because I was never cut out for it. I spent all of college being like, I don't get why everyone else knows what they want to do. And I'm the only one who's clueless. Now, that wasn't true, but it felt like it. And then I realized, oh, okay. A lot of other people, they're really lazy, so they don't want to work. So that's right. why they don't know what they want to do. But I'm working my ass off. I just don't know what an appealing career even sounds like. So I started just doing little projects that I liked. And people were like, how come you're making money doing this? How come you're making money doing that? And I was like, I don't know. It's just like an easy way to make some extra cash. And nobody was doing that. And I thought like, this is so weird. You know, there's all this business opportunity everywhere. How come no one else is trying to do anything yeah. like this? So it started when I was younger. Like I even sold fireworks. I'd go up north, go to my parents' cottage, and we'd have all these rednecky type neighbors in Michigan. And they'd be like, hey, you want to throw smoke bombs? And I'd be like, great. And they'd be like, hey, you can keep a pack and then come back next week and I'll have more. My mom's going to Ohio. So they'd give me fireworks. And I'd be like, hey, tell you what, give me all of the ones that you don't want. I'll buy them from you. You know, and they're like, oh, you have money? I'm like, yeah, I'll get you. Here's $20.
Right.
And they were like, wow, because I'm 14, right? It's a lot of money. Come back with like $60 because yep. I sold them all for $2, $3 each, the smoke bombs. And then they'd be like, well, what do you want? I'm like, when your mom goes to Ohio again, can she buy $60 worth of fireworks?
Right, right.
Sure. So I just started doing that. And my parents were like, how did you get $330? And I'm like, oh, I sold them to Linda's kids. Da, 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 da. And yep. she's like, what? You sold fireworks? Like, I don't understand. You know, like my parents didn't get it either.
I love that you're talking about this because I am a huge advocate for the premise that entrepreneurs are born, not made. Right. Mm. I don't believe that entrepreneurial school or books or seminars are going to get anybody anywhere if they're not born with the mindset. And I've yet to meet one person in my life who's a successful entrepreneur who can't trace themselves back to being 5, 10, 15, 20 and hustling something, whether it's a lemonade stand or selling, you know, like me, burned CDs of Eminem tracks, you know, when we were in high school.
I did that shit too.
That's
man.
What I'm saying. So it sounds like you're on that train then, the biology of entrepreneurship, that it isn't a learned skill.
I can get behind that because I remember early on my mom being like, my kid is a little, not in a bad way, but she's like, my kid's weird.
Yeah.
Right. Like other kids, they wanted to go to soccer. And I was like, I'm going to build an FM transmitter and I'm going to tell everyone in the neighborhood that I have a lemonade stand or that I'm selling my services as a lawnmower. And like, I'll blast it out to the radio. And my mom's like, you're going to build a little radio station in the house. Why don't you just knock on everyone's door? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. If I knock on everyone's door, I might be able to do that over a week once. They might not be home, et cetera. But if I put it on the radio, I can put it on the radio like once an hour for a week and everyone will know and they'll call the house. And my mom was like, I'm pretty sure that's illegal. And it was.
The FCC might not love that, but yeah. But that hustle is the story of virtually every entrepreneur that I know. And I love that you're talking about it because it counteracts the premise that we can be whatever we want when we grow up, right? Which is something that many people are told. And it's never caveated with like, you can be anything you want inside the bases of who you are as a human being, of how your brain is built, of what you care about, of how you think about the world. And even the way that you were saying, you saw these opportunities kind of floating in the ether and you started picking them off. And you wondered why the guy next to you doesn't see the same thing. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. And so it feels like that, you know, and I've often wondered why this is such these core premises we give young people. They can be anything they want when it's obviously not true. And so for you, it sounds like that magical intersection of who you are as a human being, how your brain is built, what you care about with what interests you and what you love doing and your passion and your drive. And they find the intersection and that brings you to the success that you've had.
I think that's true. And I'm thinking about it now, if anything, and I have great parents, but I think if anything, my upbringing almost inhibited my entrepreneur mindset in many ways. Cause I'd tell my parents, hey, I kind of don't want to go to this school. It really sucks. And my mom's like, I'm a public school teacher. You're going to a public school. You can't go to this other expensive one that like lets you do other things. And I was like, okay. And then I'd try to do something that was off the books job wise. And my dad's like, don't do that job. Don't get paid $150 a night working at this bar doing such and such. Go work at this movie theater for $5.25 an hour and you'll work your way up and you know, you can do, you report it on the taxes and da da da. And I was like, after a while, you know, I got into college and I was like, my dad's right, but he's also just not right. He works at Ford. So he doesn't have, they definitely did not want him innovating at Ford. He was a quality control guy. Like they wanted him to check every box.
I think we're the same person. My dad was a quality control guy at Chrysler. Like, I mean, the same kind of thing.
That's really funny.
Yeah. I mean, he was literally a Six Sigma quality control guy at Chrysler his whole career. And it's amazing that, because I say the same thing. My parents were amazing parents, still are, so supportive, so loving, but inhibited my entrepreneurial drive because they didn't understand it. My dad's an immigrant. He's like, you go to fucking school, you get a job, you get four degrees and you work your damn way up across 40 years and you retire. And that was the only mindset he could appreciate, which makes sense, right? As an immigrant, as somebody who didn't come with a lot.
It's low risk.
Yeah.
It's low risk. It's low risk to go to college, get a graduate degree or whatever it is, and then get a job that has a steady paycheck. That's low risk for somebody who is used to not having a steady paycheck. But I think there's, who was it that said, is it like Nicholas Nassim Taleb or something? I said, like, the three most harmful addictions are heroin, carbohydrates, and a monthly salary. So basically what he means by that, in case it's not clear for everyone, is if you get that paycheck that's steady, you're going to run into serious problems being hungry enough to start your own business mostly. Yeah. Like the reason that I was able to do so when I was a lawyer was, one, I started it before I even became a full-time lawyer, started the show, knew I liked it, found ways to monetize, had some early success, combined with what for me was pretty fortunate was working in real estate finance in 2007, 2008 hits, the entire firm gets rocked by the mortgage-backed security stuff. That's totally what I was working on. So of course, then I go, all right, well, this is over. So I basically had something I liked that was making a little bit of money that was higher risk. And then I had another job where I basically got laid off that had a steady paycheck. And I was like, guess I know what I'm doing.
Exactly.
So that was fortunate. But I think had I gotten my law job in 2001 or maybe right, I don't know, 2003, 2004, whenever the economy started to recover from September 11th, if I'd gotten my law job then, and then it was 2008, I'd have been 3, 4, 5 years in the game. I wouldn't have been like, I'm going to start a podcast, see what happens. Yeah. I'd be like, are you kidding? I have a mortgage. What are you talking about?
That's right.
I'm not starting my own thing. So you get the golden handcuffs, right? Where you're like, especially Wall Street guys, it was like, here's what you do. You get your place, you buy your condo in Manhattan, then you buy your summer place in the Hamptons, then you buy a boat for your summer place in the Hamptons, then you get married somewhere, you know, boat might come before or after you get married, but then you have kids got to go to private school. You're never quitting your law job until you're 70 because you owe $1 million a year for two houses, a boat, and private school. Like, what are you kidding?
Yeah,
you're not going anywhere.
Listen, you're preaching to the choir. When I got acquired by Salesforce, I had to work for them for a while, signed a contract, was an executive at Salesforce as a 31-year-old, which was ridiculous.
That's insane.
And had the cushiest job, I think, in the world. I was being, you know, paid an executive salary. I wasn't asked to do a ton except manage my old company, but now with a ton of support and people and everything else. And was just as comfortable as a human being can be. I had a very fortuitous position, and I lasted 7 months out of 4 years. So it's like
people don't get it. Imagine making 200 grand a year. You're like, this is awesome. Okay. But if every day sucks.
Yeah.
And then it's like, well, what you could do is quit and open up that flower shop. People are like, yeah, right.
Exactly.
Never. Yeah. How about never? And then they're like, oh, well, I'm just going to do it as a side hustle. But then you work 12-hour days at Salesforce, you come home, and on the weekends, you're supposed to, along with the fact that you now probably have kids and a wife, not you, but a lot of people have kids and a wife, you're supposed to then spend your family time opening up a bespoke cake bakery or whatever. I don't know. Well, you're not doing that. You're 100%.
And the thing is, and I think this is what people don't always appreciate, is because if everyone was like you and I, the world would come to a screeching halt. Right.
Yeah,
like,
be screwed.
I mean, we'd be fucked. This world would be the world would be over if people were like you and I. And so the reason that most people thrive in those situations and don't seek the risk and the opportunity is a good thing for the macro world, you know, that we live in, because entrepreneurs were a crazy bunch. We don't make our lives easy, and we are designed to be the 0.01% who takes that insane risk and that charge and makes the change that we make. But the rest of the world needs to be a bit more normal to keep the entire thing moving in a circle. And I imagine that your road to the level of success that you've had has not always been great and easy. So what are some of the bigger challenges? What are some of the gnarliest points of your journey in the last like decade of getting to where you are today?
I mean, first of all, I'm in a creative endeavor, right? I'm doing a podcast, The Jordan Harbinger Show. So there's no obvious map. And I don't know if this is just a creative endeavor thing, but I hear this complaint a lot from creatives. I think, you know, if you're running a SaaS company, software as a service, you get a bunch of users, you scale it, you spend a bunch of investor money if you have to scale it, then you exit to a big company like Salesforce, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
And you do it right. Or you go public, right? One of the two. But if you're in a creative endeavor like me, you go, all right, I have a show and it's got a lot of people. Oh, where do they find you? Ah, word of mouth. Cool. How do you scale that? I don't know. Like tell people to tell their friends. Yeah, that's not happening.
Right.
Okay, cool. Do we just rely on Google to eventually fix discovery for podcasting? Well, that's not a great strategy. Oh, right. No, but Spotify is going to eventually fix it. Cool. Are they going to pick you or are they going to pick somebody else?
Right.
That's going to be like the darling that gets all the attention and then blows you up. You know, what's going to happen. So there's no defined plan. So every time people are like, oh, what are you doing to grow your show? I noticed you're on the top of the list here. I'm like, oh, I spent $150,000 on digital ads. 130 of it is completely wasted. I should have just lit it on fire. At least I would have been warm. And the last 20K seems to have done something. So now I'm going to focus on that. By the way, I have like no money left, you know, or whatever. Or like now I have to wait another while and explain why I can't afford to buy another house or like can't afford to finish construction of my house or whatever. You know, like there's all these things that you do. And then also people go, oh, well, what, you know, are you hiring? Are you going to scale? And then you got that typical entrepreneur issue where you're like, well, I'm the only person who can do this and this and this and this and this. Now I'm not going to hire anyone.
Right.
Well, cool. I'll keep working 15 hour days and see how you last.
Yeah.
So scaling, having no predefined pathway to success is tricky, but that's why other people aren't really doing it.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I'm not saying SaaS, software as a service, is easy. It's just that other people have done it. So there's some inkling of where you want to go, but it's not like, oh, step one, start SaaS company. Step two, put money into social media ads. Every dollar turns into $2 magically. Step three, sell to Salesforce. There's all these unknowns along the way.
Right.
And I know this because I know you and I know a ton of other SaaS people. It's like very common right now to run a SaaS company. And they're like, I got to hire a dev who can do this thing. Oh, cool. What other companies have done that? Oh, right. No one. That's why your company is unique. So you have to figure out how to do this thing on a computer that's never been done. And you've got to hire people that can help figure this out with you and aren't just going to leave you in the lurch or steal your IP. Okay. Good luck.
What is your single biggest day-to-day challenge today?
Single biggest day-to-day challenge, I think, is figuring out how to put money into the show and get more listeners out of the other end.
Right.
Speeding up growth. Like, I'm growing, but am I growing at the rate I want to be? Not really. Then again, is that also, and I play this game with myself all the time, or am I growing and that's a great rate, except for nobody's here to say, no, that's a really good rate, Jordan, because I'm a business owner. And of course I want to double every year,
yeah.
But that's not really how business works. Right. So like, that's not how your business is going to work. I don't know. So I spend a lot of time fluctuating between this sucks, I'm never going to succeed, and wow, look at how much, look, I can't believe we did all that this year. This is so amazing. I'm so impressed with everybody on the team. Yeah. You know, I go back and forth depending on my mood, and I don't even have like bipolar disorder, like a lot of other entrepreneurs do. Right. Like those guys, they have it worse.
So you have succeeded by every measurable metric in the podcasting world. And so what do you think is next for you? I mean, cause of course you can get bigger and there's more ears that are going to listen to you on a daily or weekly basis. But like,
yeah,
what is the, you're a big brain guy. What's the vision? What's like really coming next for you in the show?
Yeah. You know, I have a kid now, so I have to be kind of cognizant not to just crawl in a hole and spend all this time looking at like Google spreadsheets to try and figure this out. I realize also, and this is an important distinction that I think a lot of people never make, or they wait years and years and years to make it and they shouldn't. There's a big difference between running a growth company and running a lifestyle business. And a lot of people who run lifestyle businesses like me, I'm running a lifestyle business. I have to, it's like going to Alcoholics Anonymous and being like, I'm Jordan, I run a lifestyle business. There's all these people that think they're running a growth company. So they'll spend like 17 hour days, literally working 7 days a week. And it's like, you got to hire for this. I got to be doing that. I got to do this. I got to do that. We got to do a loan and take on venture debt. And it's like, wait, what is your goal? And they're like, well, we want to scale and scale and scale. And then what? I'm never going to be able to sell the Jordan Harbinger show, and because I have to run it. So what's the point, right? Maybe a Spotify's like, here's $50 million. You know,
the Joe Rogan effect.
Joe Rogan.
Yeah.
You know, I get a Rogan deal. Cool. But Rogan still owns his show. He just has a royalty deal or whatever deal. Spotify.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, I've come to the conclusion that what I want to do is I do want to grow because it feels good, but in many ways it's just kind of gambling. I want to grow, I want to scale, but the reason I want to do that is, and I have this little meter in my head, like a speedometer, like a RPM meter, where if I'm doing it and it hits the red and it's for ego, I have to like ease off the gas a little bit and realize, no, what I really need to be doing this for is spending a lot of quality time with my wife and kids and my family, enjoying what life has to offer, because I don't get the point of making like $10 million if you're one of those people who's like doing coke at 4 a.m. to get up and go do your thing at the office. There's a lot of that on Wall Street.
Lots.
So I really do have to like take time to enjoy things. And so now I'm working really hard. My kid's one. So this makes a big difference because I work from home. He's home all the time. But when my kid is a little older, I don't want to be like, I can't go on that camping trip with you guys. Got to work. Oh, you know what? Can't go on vacation with you guys. Got to work. I've got to be the dad who's like, hey, bring the friends that we can stand to Africa. We're going to go on a safari and we're going to be there for 2.5 weeks. And I know that Timmy's parents can't come with us because they work at the law firm, but we'll take them.
Right.
And it'll be fun and it'll be a blast. And like, I'm working hard so that when I've got my kids in school and I'm the dad that goes to all the games, and I'm the dad that can like set up the camping trips, that I want other people to go, what the hell does that guy do?
Right.
He's like never busy. You know, that's what I want.
I think that's awesome. And I think that the measure of busyness is something that we've got way too consumed in as an American culture.
Yeah.
Most places in the world do not respect busyness, right? They respect optimization and quality of life. In America, it's one of our key metrics. People brag about being busy. And it sounds like you've crossed that chasm of figuring out that is not the solution to the entrepreneurial itch.
Yeah, it's not. And I am the king of being like, oh, I don't have anything to do. It's Sunday. I should rearrange the spreadsheet so that all the colors are in order for no reason other than it looks better and I feel like I'm working. Or like, oh, you know, I should really zero out my LinkedIn inbox. Why? You know, why? Oh, well, it's got stuff in it.
Right.
I mean, I have that sort of like anal retentive, I think is the technical definition for it. Like I've got to have everything. I like my desk has parallels and perpendicular things set up on it. I have to deliberately not do that to myself, you know? And it's not really OCD, but it's like when you walked in here, you might be like, this guy's pretty organized.
A little specific. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome. And it's such a great lesson for people to hear, because I think especially people who are aspiring entrepreneurs who may have the biology, who may be predisposed to succeed at some point, they get caught up in, can I create enough busyness? And when that will that drive me to success, instead of finding that crosshatch that you have, which is what am I built for? Then what am I really fucking good at? And let's put those two things together.
There are so many people I know that say things like, oh, I just don't have time to do all that prep that you do. And I'm like, but okay, why? What are you doing? And they're like, well, I've got to do social media. And I'm like, yeah, let me stop you right there. You don't have to do anything. Oh, but don't I have to post clips of the show on Instagram? No. Well, why is everyone else doing that? Because some social media entrepreneur agency said, you got to put your stuff on Instagram and clips and it'll increase engagement. Why?
Yeah.
Spend that $2,000 a month in time hiring someone to do that. And then you'll find out that it doesn't do shit.
Yep.
And then you can take that $2,000 a month and put it into advertising and get, you know, 500 new listeners instead of five from social media. You know, like all of these distractions that people get obsessed with, often they're just a message that we get either from other people trying to sell us something, which is like 50% of it, or it's busyness. It's, I don't see you why aren't you doing Facebook Lives? Because I just want podcast listeners. I don't want to answer questions on Facebook Live. Well, you're going to get a bigger audience. Cool. But to what end? They're not listening to my podcast.
Right.
I'm just building a machine that I have to feed. I'm building a big generator that only powers itself, that takes a shitload of gas.
Yeah.
Right. Like, why would I do that?
100%. It's great insight, man. Honestly, it's I respect what you've done so much. I'm actually just laughing into myself of how similar we are in our backgrounds and even where we grew up. I didn't really realize your dad is actually an auto guy like mine was.
Yeah, that's really, I think really that's, like
it's phenomenal.
Super unusual coincidence, but it makes sense. You have your stuff turned up to 11. It's like another conversation, but you know, looking at your story, I'm like, ooh, this guy like really got in the weeds and like really got obsessed over stuff and really leveraged everything. I don't have the same type of risk tolerance probably that you do. That's another entrepreneur thing. That's probably a whole different conversation, is the tolerance for risk, especially when we're young, is crazy. Like I can't even count the number of friends of mine. When I was growing up, exactly zero friends of mine were into like, maybe there was a couple people who were like, we went skydiving.
Right.
Now my friends are like, hey, why don't I drive my convertible at high speed around a mountain pass with no guardrail to get to the place where we're going to kiteboard underneath the Golden Gate Bridge around these giant Chinese ships that could kill you with their wake, you know, so that you can get extra air. And then, yeah, we're going to go on a vacation where we like shoot machine guns in Afghanistan. And it's like, what the hell? And then these are the same guys that run like an online payment company.
Right,
like,
exactly.
Why do you do that? And they're like, their tolerance for risk is insane. You hear about like, yeah, I leveraged my grandma's house and my wife's house and my savings and my college tuition. And then I sold a kidney and then I started my company and we got lucky. And I'm like, so many guys with our same wiring are like in jail.
100%. Yeah.
Dead.
100%.
Yeah.
And it's great insight. And I'm so happy to have the chance to talk to you and to switch sides of the table and actually interview you. I know you got to go, so we'll let this get done. So really do appreciate it, Jordan. And for all the listeners who don't listen to the Jordan Harbinger Show, you need to click over and listen to Jordan's amazing podcast and hopefully have you on again on this show, talk more entrepreneurship and talk more about some what you've learned from your amazing guests on that side.
Thanks, dude. I really appreciate the time. This is a lot of fun.
Jordan's been a good buddy of mine and a mentor since getting into this podcasting world. His show is fantastic, so I hope everyone goes and checks out The Jordan Harbinger Show. If you haven't read my book, A Practical Way to Get Rich and Die Trying, it's now available on Amazon and at all online booksellers, plus in person at Barnes & Noble. You can follow me on social media. I'm at John Roa. That's J-O-H-N-R-O-A. And the podcast at @betweenus_pod. A big thanks to Jam Street Media, my producers, Casey Franco and Maddie Stout. We'll see you guys next week. Be safe.